Philippine lawmakers looking to wrap up the congressional canvass to proclaim the winners of the presidential and vice presidential races today. Later on in the program, we'll speak with historian Manolo Quezon on the challenges facing the incoming Marcos administration. Lawyer-turned-blogger Trixie Angeles accepts her nomination to be the next press secretary. And U.S. President Joe Biden pushes for tighter gun control laws following the latest deadly school shooting in America. Hi, I'm Carmina Constantino. Dateline Philippines begins right now. Hey, thanks for joining us. For those of you watching us on YouTube and on Facebook, glad you could join us today. We begin with the ongoing congressional canvass at the Batasang Pambansa. Lawmakers have already sifted through more than half of the certificates of canvass, and they will try to finish the task today. The canvass is expected to formalize the victory of the tandem of Ferdinand Marcos Jr. and Sara Duterte Carpio in the May 9 polls. Our correspondent Audrey Cruz will join us later for an update. Well, turning now to another big story, a resounding grief in the U.S. as the nation faces its deadliest school shooting in nearly a decade. At least 21 killed, most of them children, after a gunman opened fire at an elementary school in Texas. ABS-CBN's North America Bureau Chief TJ Manotok now joins us with an update. TJ, good afternoon from Manila. Over to you.
Carmina, good evening. You know, it's just 10 days since the horrific mass shooting in Buffalo, New York, that saw a then 18-year-old kill 10 innocent people in a community grocery store. The U.S. is once again reeling with another unimaginable mass shooting. This time, a shooter taking the lives of 19 young children and two adults at the Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas. At around noontime today, the shooter, now known as Salvador Ramos, came into the Robb Elementary School and opened fire, taking down innocent children and teachers. Ramos is also dead, and it is believed that he was gunned down by law enforcement. Authorities reported that Ramos also likely shot and killed his own grandmother before heading to the school. They found an AR-15 rifle with numerous magazines and said he was wearing tactical body armor gear. Uvalde is just an hour away from one of Texas's largest metropolis, San Antonio, whose mayor, Ron Nirenberg, is of Filipino descent on his mother's side. Mayor Nirenberg tweeted his disgust on the sickening attack and sent his support team to their neighboring town. Philam, California Attorney General Rob Bonta also weighed in, as he also sent his condolences, but took it a step further in expressing his frustration that children cannot be protected until nationwide action is done to prevent gun violence. Philam Congressman from Virginia, Bobby Scott, says he refuses to take the status quo from colleagues who will just offer prayers and condolences with no real action. At the White House, fresh from his trip from Asia, an emotional President Joe Biden appealed to lawmakers to turn this pain into action.
As a nation, we have to ask, when in God's name are we going to stand up to the gun lobby? When in God's name we do what we all know in our gut needs to be done? Why are we willing to live with this carnage? Why do we keep letting this happen? Where in God's name is our backbone to have the courage to deal with it and stand up to the lobbies? It's time to turn this pain into action for every parent, for every citizen in this country. We have to make it clear to every elected official in this country. It's time to act.
Carmina, this is now the worst mass shooting in the U.S. since the 2012 Sandy Hook massacre that also saw 20 young elementary school kids dead, along with 6 staff members. Carmina?
All right, TJ, of course, we're talking about the shooting. It just happened. We're talking about the investigation that will be underway, various reactions as well. But we got to talk about the effect as well on the parents and the children. You look at social media, and there are parents and various reports, and there are parents who are saying they don't want to send their kids to school anymore because of what happened. Talk to us about that.
Well, that's the chilling effect right now of parents, you know, with their kids going to schools in areas that they know don't have the best gun laws. They've seen it happen time and again in their state, in their counties, and this just adds to the paranoia and to the trauma. I was reading some reports today from various accounts of how parents are finding out of what happened to their kids. There is a convention center nearby the school where initially during the day was a reunification center. But reporters were noting that once in a while they would hear howls and cries and screams from inside the convention center, even though they're given a distance away from the doors because they're supposed to keep their distance. And the fact that they can hear the emotions of the people in there, you can just imagine those were parents finding out that their kids were part of those who were either hurt or killed. Remember today, Carmina, the initial count was 14. Mm-hmm. And after a few hours, they added that body count of children to 19 because I presume the other five passed away in the hospital. And it's just horrific to see and to note, Carmina, these are kids from grade 2 to grade 4. That's how young they were. And, you know, President Biden, you know, you just saw a snippet of his speech, but he actually spoke for 7 minutes. That was the latter part where he just showed his emotion that was more anger, expressing it towards those in legislature who are refusing to take action. But prior to that, he was so emotional in expressing his compassion and sympathy for parents who have lost a child. Let's remember, Biden himself has lost a son, right? So he knows the pain of losing a child, although not that young. And you can see how he was grieving with them. And it's just difficult to fathom now that, you know, you're seeing numerous accounts of people saying, how will they see those empty beds at night tonight? And that's horrors that those parents are living with right now.
Well, it's simply not right. Our North America Bureau Chief there, T.J. Manotok, joining us live via Zoom from San Francisco. Thanks, T.J. Thank you for joining us today. Well, back here in the newsroom, social media abuzz with calls for stricter gun controls following that tragic shooting. Basketball superstar LeBron James took to Twitter to extend his prayers to the victims, adding, "Schools are supposed to be the safest." James' leader called for urgently needed change. Meanwhile, First Lady Jill Biden used three words to summarize what most people probably feel: angry, stunned, and heartbroken. Former First Lady Hillary Clinton tweeted, "America simply needs legislators willing to stop the source of gun violence that is murdering the children." And Democratic Senator Chris Murphy delivered an emotional speech, prodding his colleagues for action.
But I'm here on this floor to beg, to literally get down on my hands and knees and beg my colleagues. Find a path forward here. Work with us to find a way to pass laws that make this less likely. I understand my Republican colleagues will not agree to everything that I may support, but there is a common denominator that we can find.
And going back to our top story now, let's get an update on day two of the congressional canvass at the Batasang Pambansa. Our very own RG Cruz is there, and he joins us now with the latest. RG, what more can you tell us?
Carmina, good afternoon. Earlier today, House Majority Leader Martin Romualdez, one of the co-chairs of the Joint Congressional Canvassing Committee, announced that the proclamation of the country's next president and vice president, the winners of the 2022 presidential elections, will be done before the end of the day. This as the committee proceeded to canvass 127 out of the 173 certificates of canvass it needs to canvass before it can proclaim a winner. That's about 73.41% of the canvassed COCs. Going over the results as of this moment, Ferdinand Marcos still leading the race, 30,224,914. Lenny Robredo, 14,557,216. Manny Pacquiao, 3,617,440. Isko Moreno Dumagoso, 1,599,592. Panfilo Lacson, 861,551. Faisal Mangondato, 295,185. Ernesto Abella, 112,883. Diodegario de Guzman, 90,403. Norberto Gonzalez, 88,244. And Jose Montemayor, 59,034. In the vice presidential race, Sara Duterte with 30,676,422. Kiko Pangilinan, 9,029,990. Vicente Soro III, 8,011,652. Willie Ong, 1,678,198. Lito Atienza, 261,697. Manny Lopez, 152,119. Walden Bello, 98,278. Carlos Serapio, 89,649. And Rizalito David, 55,183. So we are expecting the committee proceedings to be finished within this afternoon. And true to what Majority Leader Romualdez said earlier today, they will proclaim they will reconvene the joint public session to approve the committee report that will be submitted by the Joint Congressional Canvassing Committee, as well as the resolution of both houses that will proclaim Ferdinand Marcos Jr. and Inday Sara Duterte as the next president and vice president of the Philippines. Carmina?
All right, RJ, as you said, Martin Romualdez there saying that the proclamation will happen before the day's end. Talk to us about the preparations that are ongoing for this. Talk to us about the movement and how soon can the future president and vice president of this country make their way there to the Batasang Pambansa as soon as Congress has stopped their counting there.
Well, we have no official word yet as to how the two have been informed already, but we do understand from experience, from history, that there are always informal and unofficial heads-ups or notices given to the winners so that they can pre-position themselves near the Batasan or in the area of the Batasan so that they can be proclaimed as soon as the results are in. So, insofar as preparations are concerned, there really isn't much that is going on because what they're going to do is just going to be, they're just going to be approving the committee report, proclaiming the next president. Of course, they will be asking everybody who attended the, all the lawmakers, the senators and the congressmen to attend the joint public session when it reconvenes, whether here in person in the session hall or virtually. So that's about it.
Right, so we're just going to have to wait and see. Our correspondent RJ Cruz there joining us live from the Batasang Pambansa. Thanks, RJ. Take care. Keep safe. Well, back here in the newsroom, the change in leadership in Malacañang will come as the Philippines continues to recover from this pandemic as well as the economic impact of the ongoing war in Ukraine. Let's tackle the challenges facing the next administration with historian and Philippine Daily Inquirer columnist Manolo Quezon. Manolo, good afternoon to you. Nice to see you again. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi, thanks, Carmina.
All right, so talk to us first about the numbers. Congress finishing or preparing to wrap up their canvassing at the Batasang Pambansa. You wrote in your article today that he has garnered the third highest, at least in percentage, in history. Talk to us more about that.
Well, I think, you know, in terms of elections, because our population's always increasing, mm-hmm. the only way you're going to be able to compare mandates is through percentages. And this percentage is, as I said, the third highest in our electoral history. You have to go back to 1953 and 1935 to find a candidate who got higher. Higher, in fact, than the soon-to-be president-elect's own father in 1965. So in that sense, it is the first majority mandate we have experienced under our present Fifth Republic, which started in 1987. It's the first majority achieved by a presidential candidate without a big debate about it since 1965 or 69, but that was a re-election. So it's remarkable in that sense. And now with a remarkable majority comes remarkably high expectations.
Exactly. And so let's get mm-hmm. into that right now. What will this mandate mean for him? What will this mandate look like for the people? What are your expectations?
Okay, this is one thing I've had to remind people. There's in our political culture, election is absolution for someone who is facing a controversy. You can agree or disagree about it, but that is how it's often been perceived. And that's why some people have run for office precisely to achieve that. Jose P. Laurel in 1949 and so on. Now, So in that sense, the Marcoses can claim vindication resulting in a restoration. That brings its own set of problems, among which is, together with your new allies, you have to please a lot of people who stayed loyal to you through thick and thin over the years and who maybe have also suffered with you and therefore feel that this is their time to get something back. There's that. There's the simple fact that this is a remarkable mandate at a time of remarkable challenge because we're emerging from a pandemic that basically has left the government with a gigantic debt and very few resources to fill that debt and pay forward what it needs to do. So some hard choices are going to have to be made very soon by the incoming new government. So a lot of things to expect there. A lot of people are going to be looking at the composition of the cabinet. And, you know, there was talk made that the new team would be announced after the proclamation by Congress. Well, because it's happening so quickly, it's going to have to be announced fairly soon. And of these, the most important, of course, is Secretary of Finance. Let's not forget that there is also no national security team as of yet. You have no word on who will be the Secretary of National Defense or who will be the National Security Advisor. So those are the sort of twin pillars that you're looking at in an administration.
All right.
So beyond that, it's the ability or lack of it of a new team to hit the ground running in the term that was made popular by President Ramos. You're going to be looking at two events about a month apart to see where this government is going to be headed.
What are
the
these
first,
two
of
events?
Course, these two events, of course, are the inaugural. The inauguration of the new president and their inaugural address. The problem is they can't even figure out where the best place to hold it would be because, you know, the Quirino Grandstand is being used for COVID purposes. So that's a bit of a problem. The second, of course, is the State of the Nation address, which would be the first State of the Nation address of the new president, who will be expected to have a tremendously big majority in both houses with a very, very weak opposition. So there's really nothing in the way of the president-elect getting what he wants except his ability to pacify or keep happy what is a big but independent-minded coalition. Because, you know, half of it is Marcos loyalists and the other half are Duterte loyalists. And they do not necessarily have the same interests, especially in the long term.
And on the flip side, very quickly, they would have to be able to sustain the momentum from the large, remarkable mandate that he has gotten through the two events that you mentioned, not for the politicians that backed them, but this time for the 31 million that who voted for him.
Not just the 31 million. Remember, I think it's pretty ingrained in our culture as a people that once a president is proclaimed and once a president takes their oath of office, everyone basically gives the new president a chance. Now, to be sure, one in four or up to one in three, depending on how you measure it, Filipinos did not pick this administration and, in fact, are violently opposed to it, not in terms of using force, but in terms of the depths of their feelings. So there will have to be a lot of reaching across the aisle and a lot of gestures to sort of dial down the fears of these sectors of the population
which we're gonna
for
get
the
to,
new government to succeed.
Which we're going to get to in a bit. We're going to have to talk about communication and how crucial this is for the incoming administration to pin this down. But first, I want to go back to what you said about absolution. Is this transferable to the Vice President, Sara Duterte Carpio? We do know that there have been a lot of criticisms regarding the presidency of her father. What does her win mean now? Is this
her
also
win,
vindication?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Her win, by the way, is also the third highest vice presidential win in our history. And vice presidents tend to get higher votes than the presidents because the contest isn't as intense. So on her own, and that is the important thing about our system, compared to other systems. We vote for them separately because when we had our first presidential election in 1935, they felt that if a vice president was ever called upon to become president, they had to have their own mandate to be considered legitimate by the people. What does this mean? The incoming vice president has an even bigger mandate than the president that traditionally causes a lot of jealousy between the two positions. It also means that she can, with great fairness and justice, say at least half of this outcome was because of the Duterte brand and the Duterte base of support. Mm. This cannot be ignored, and it expects to be respected and given a share of the seats at the table. Mm. Now, moving forward, how much this happens and whether they feel that their feelings are and rights are being taken into account will be, I think, more important politically than anything any opposition group or person does, at least until the midterms. Mm. So it is a reminder that one of the reasons that for the first time we were able to have a majority president and vice president is because of the political capital that the president, let's not forget, mm-hmm. didn't want to spend this way, but which got spent for him anyway because of his daughter.
Mm. Let's go back to the topic of communication, Manolo, something that's very close to your heart as well, being that you were part of department during the Pinoy administration. Talk to us about how important this is for this administration to pin down, how crucial it is, especially coming from a very nasty, toxic campaign period where you don't even know if there was any communication that was happening then. Talk to us about where they're going to bring this now. How important is it? Go ahead.
Okay, the first thing we saw was that the campaign itself was waged on two levels. On the part of the presidential candidate and his running mate, it was waged on a level that always maintained the high ground, refused to say anything that attacked anyone, only stuck to the key talking points of unity, and it worked. It worked very well. At the same time, there was a very aggressive and thorough campaign waged in a sense underground or in the informal channels. And this also involved the assistance of allies in mainstream media. Mm-hmm. So what does this tell us? It tells us that the president-elect or the soon-to-be president-elect will not be the one to do any attacking. People will be there to attack for him. He will focus on appearing above the fray and therefore maintain a certain level of plausible deniability for the actions of allies, friends, or even subordinates. Mm. You have a government infrastructure that has already pivoted towards a more Chinese and Russian orientation simply because there has been technology transfer and training undertaken under the present administration. Mm. What the present administration may be lacking is what will be supplied by the kind of leadership that the new president decides to take on. Mm. So it will be one that is keeps traditional media, shall we say, at arm's length, but embraces non-traditional media. One that will look at using social media, both formally and informally, but with a unified thrust. Mm. One that also, by its nature, maintains a kind of friendly solidarity or at the very least cooperation between the separate social media teams of the Duterte machinery and the Marcos machinery, because not always will those see eye to eye or have the same points of view. Mm. But right now they will remain united because of changes in the media landscape where traditional media has lost audience. you will find that the non-traditional or the new players will fill in the void and will try to grab and hold audience share as a result.
So basically, more of the same. But talk to us now about...
But probably even perhaps more smoothly run.
Mm-hmm. But they've laid the foundation perfectly
well. Oh, yes,
well,
absolutely. Absolutely.
Already. But talk to us about the difference you think that this may have from the regime of his father's. During the Marcos dictatorship, propaganda, the propaganda machinery was really there. And they informed through propaganda. Are you expecting more of the same, especially because of, as you said, the changing landscape? It has evolved. It's easier now to get the information that they want the people to get. Go ahead.
Well, fundamentally, I think one aspect we have to consider is President Marcos achieved, he was only the second president in our history to be reelected. But he did that at the moment that our whole society was changing and fracturing. That's the first quarter storm. So after achieving incredible heights of success, he suddenly faced incredible challenges. The result was having to mount a coup from within, which is what martial law was. You don't have to do that under Marcos Part 2. Mm. Every institution can be expected to behave. Every institution can be expected to be a partner. The institutions that may not be inclined to roll over and have their belly rubbed, let's say the churches or even the old media, even academe, can be limited and kept in isolation precisely by the infrastructure they have in place for reaching out to the public, for cultivating their constituency and keeping them organized and aggressive. Mm. That places everyone else and everything else on the defensive so that you don't necessarily have to engage in the extreme methods that we remember from martial law. Mm. You may still have to do it from time to time, but more perhaps in the manner of President Arroyo, where you do a little sampling, or even President Duterte, you just do it a few times enough and it keeps everyone in their place.
Mm. Talk to us about your experience then when you were part of the PCOO and keeping, media in their place and making sure that, they get to do their job while you get to also further what you believed in should be out there. Was there ever a point when you said, let's keep them at bay. Let's only give them what they need to know. It's the survival of this administration that's more important to us.
Looking back, first of all, I wasn't part of PCOO. There was a split, and there was messaging, which was us, and dissemination, which is PCOO. So that was based on the White House model. I think it's really the fundamental approach you take. There is a difference when your attitude is starting with what you cannot do. So from the start, there were things that we were not allowed to do or not even allowed to consider to do. And it could be even something as simple as, let's say, making infomercials to be shown in the movies, because the president told us that's too Marcosian. Mm. So you have, an approach that focuses on self-control is very different from an approach that focuses on making control more effective. And therefore, it also means that an approach where the media is viewed as the fourth estate, essentially a institution that is co-equal with government, mm-hmm. is very different from an administration that will view media as an enemy to be tamed, which I think will be a view that you will encounter moving forward. So it's really... Now, of course... President Marcos Sr. himself once said, nothing succeeds like success. Mm-hmm. From the point of view of Filipino psychology, pushing the envelope is watched. And every time you get away with pushing the envelope, in our culture at least, it adds to your political strength because it adds to your political prestige and the intimidation of your enemies.
Let's move on from there and go to another topic. Transition that's happening as we speak. How tedious of a process is this? And talk to us about what really happens behind the scenes as you usher in the next administration, as you say goodbye to the current administration.
There was an estimate a few years ago that an incoming president has about 10,000 appointments to make when they're about to enter into office. So you're talking about a huge number of people who are going to lose their jobs, combined with a huge number of people who are going to find new jobs, and the adjustments all of this includes, including, by the way, that government processes are so slow that most of the incoming people are not going to really have salaries for the first 6 months. So essentially what you have is really a lot of packing going on, and it already started, I mean, during the campaign, and the preparation of documents that no one reads, listing basically the ongoing resources and policies of the different departments, which will be handed over to those who will be coming in. Mm. Now, the big problem, of course, is matching the two. So there will be committees formed by the existing president and the incoming president. They will be sitting down sort of exchanging notes on what to expect. Mm. This is where past experience can help a lot, because, like I told you, we're all focused on the cabinet, but of course there are many positions below the cabinet, and for those who are appointed with previous government service, they therefore have a better chance of being able to recruit and bring in a qualified team, or at the very least to identify people in the existing offices that can help them. Mm-hmm. For those who will be new, it will be a bit of a trauma, because you will then realize that you may have all the responsibility, but for the first 6 months, very little of the means to do the job you're expected to do.
Yeah. And you can just imagine that all that you said on warp speed, because this particular administration, the incoming administration, the canvassing and all that, it's moving quite fast. So all that plus the element of time, you can just imagine what kind of scenario is happening behind the scenes as we speak.
Just for our viewers, in the past, it would be sort of mid-June when Congress would eventually make its proclamation, because, you know, there's a lot of noise and fighting going on. This time, because of the scale of the mandate, the other candidates conceded quite quickly, and therefore we're sort of a month ahead of schedule almost. This means also that the incoming president has to put that team together and announce it very soon. This is particularly true for the economic team. They were off to a good start with Arsenio Balisacan, but really the person to watch is who will be drafted to be Secretary of Finance.
Yeah, and we sort of go a full circle here, because that sort of also lends to the sustaining of the momentum. When you see the population or the cabinet post being populated, and you see all these names, and you know that that helps keep the momentum right there. You mentioned the nomination of former NEDA chief Arsenio Balisacan. He was part of the Pinoy administration. What do you make of that nomination?
Well, I think the president-elect was the one who answered it best, because he said that, you know, they knew each other and they're friends. So I think this is Ilocano speaking to Ilocano first and foremost. But also, in the same statement, the president-elect-to-be also said, you know, he did a good job in the NEDA, and that's what I want him to keep on doing. So in that sense, yes, I mean, even before the election, people were already sort of discussing behind the scenes that perhaps it would be to the former Aquino administration that the new administration would look for economic names, for one reason or another. Now, that may proved to be the case. It doesn't necessarily have to be the case. Mm-hmm. It just shows you that the incoming government is conscious of the fact that because of the fiscal and other strains that the new government will be experiencing, it has to put in place a team that has credibility, not just nationally, but internationally.
Mm, but behind the scenes, though, the team that puts together this team, do we know anything about that?
No, we don't. We only have what's been mentioned in, you know, and everyone, of course, everyone now claims to be in the know. So it ranges everywhere from the future First Lady to, you know, Anton Lagnameo to Benhur Abalos, and of course Vic Rodriguez, who's going to be the next executive secretary, and even Iñigo Sobel, because he's close to the incoming president. So beyond that, nothing has been confirmed. I mean, these are all just names floating around.
But why is it important for the public to know the team behind the official team of
well, it president. Gives you an insight into the kind of advice the president-elect is getting, and who is their inner circle, who do they trust to sort of be the jobs fair for their incoming administration. That's usually the first insight you get, and usually, you know, every incoming administration wants to sort of at least send the signal that they have credible, competent, and sober people looking at it. Because no president can humanly be expected to decide on every one of all the many names they have to pick.
A final two questions for you, Manolo. Today, what are the challenges do you think that this administration will face, apart, of course, from the pandemic recovery?
The most fundamental question that I think will hang over this administration is, will it be focused on making a name for itself or getting even? And what balance of the two will there be? Because at the end of the day, every president is human. So which will they look to the better angels of their natures, or is this payback time? The fate of certain corporations will be looked at very closely for signs of this that has repercussions politically and economically. The question on what will happen to critics, but not just within, you know, official circles, but in the wider world, will also be looked at. The incoming president's behavior and that of the new first family will also be taken, because, again, as much as history was repurposed and therefore made useful politically for, you know, the second Marcos administration, it also still weighs heavily on them. And in this case, I mean, even in the selection of a cabinet, the incoming president's biggest obstacle was getting over the reputation of his father for assembling competent cabinets. So in that sense, he has an uphill climb ahead of him.
And finally, Manolo, we still do not know how this administration will go down in history. But as a historian, how do you think the beginnings of this Marcos Jr. presidency will be written, or is being written as we speak?
Well, it's already being written as what it is, a remarkable restoration. Restorations in and of themselves are nothing new and are really actually part of the cycle of ups and downs in many societies. We're not unique that way. But this is one that has relied on something fundamentally new, which is the techniques of convincing and teaching. Now, how long that can be maintained really depends on the ability to do old-fashioned things like delivering jobs, food, security, and eventually on those old-fashioned sort of basic questions that the future will be determined.
Manolo Quezon there, columnist of the Philippine Daily Inquirer. Thank you so much for joining us today. Lovely talking to you as always. Take care and keep safe.
Glad to be back. Thanks.
And from there, we're going to take a quick break. Up ahead, a lawyer-turned-blogger joins the incoming Marcos cabinet. Details of that story and more when Dateline Philippines returns. Stay with us here on ANC. And we're back. You're still with Dateline Philippines. Here's another look at our headlines this noon. Philippine lawmakers looking to wrap up the congressional canvass to proclaim the winners of the presidential and vice presidential races today. Lawyer-turned-blogger Trixie Angeles accepts her nomination to be the next press secretary. And U.S. President Joe Biden pushes for tighter gun control laws following the latest deadly school shooting in America. Back with more news, radio commentator and pro-Duterte blogger Trixie Cruz Angeles set to be the press secretary of the incoming Marcos administration. The Marcos camp says Cruz Angeles has already accepted the offer. Her primary task is to oversee the operations of the Presidential Communications Operations Office. She was also a social media strategist of the PCOO from July 2017 until 2018 under President Rodrigo Duterte. In 2016, the Supreme Court suspended Cruz Angeles from practicing law for 3 years for violating the Lawyer's Code of Conduct. She has since become a radio show host and a prominent blogger supportive of the Duterte administration. Opening the Bataan nuclear power plant is on the table again after presidential frontrunner Marcos Jr. said he is considering reviving his father's project. But as Jackie Pascual tells us, some groups are against this proposal.
The Bataan nuclear power plant has been mothballed for over 3 decades now. But this may change, with presumptive President Ferdinand Bongbong Marcos saying he may open the nuclear power plant, a project of his father, the late President Ferdinand Marcos Sr. The Bataan nuclear power plant cost about $2.2 billion to build and was allegedly linked to corruption. It was not opened in 1986 due to various issues and because of the Chernobyl nuclear disaster. The group Nuclear Free Bataan Movement opposes its possible reopening. It says nuclear power plants are harmful to public health and the environment.
Mapanganib yung pagkakatayo at mismong nuclear power plant ay hindi siya magandang source ng energy dahil unang-una na yung usapin ng waste, no, yung radioactive waste.
The group adds the plant stands near a fault line, which is not an ideal place for a nuclear plant. The cost of opening and operating a nuclear power plant are also high.
Tapos ngayon, napakadami nating utang. Bankrupt na yung ating gobyerno. Tapos uutang na naman tayo para sa rehabilitation. Sabi rin nila noon sa Trimal Island, safe. Pero yun nga, yung safety is a myth. Pangalawa, yung Chernobyl. Kung sana kung natuto na sila sa Trimal Island, di sana wala ng Chernobyl. Hindi pa sila natuto sa Chernobyl. Nagkaroon pa ng mas malaking problema dito sa Fukushima.
The Bataan nuclear power plant has not been used, but government is spending 25 to 30 million pesos a year for maintenance. A BNPP official says, based on initial information, the power plant can still be called to service.
Based doon sa nag-conduct dito ng feasibility study, yung dalawang grupo, yung Korean, yung tsaka yung Rosatom, yung sabi niya sa yung parang walang paiwatig pero walang official report na 4 to 5 years kaya pa andarin yan and will amount $1 billion.
President Rodrigo Duterte has urged the incoming administration to study whether nuclear energy is needed by the country, especially as the growing economy needs more power. For now, the Bataan nuclear power plant is a tourist attraction, with guests entering the site for a minimal fee. Visitors just need to book an appointment online. Jackie Pascual, ABS-CBN News.
A Palawan Provincial Information Officer denies allegations made against a controversial reclamation project in Coron. Attorney Christian Cojamco says it had consulted affected local government units and barangays before the project continued in 2018. Cojamco also asserts the project did not exceed its 51-hectare boundary. He adds the project would continue should government
reinstate its Environmental Compliance Certificate, or ECC, which had been canceled earlier this month. The project also faces a fine of 50,000 pesos. On Tuesday, the group Sagip Coron said the reclamation project did not have a prior consultation and that it went beyond the quarrying area.
We will only file a motion for reconsideration on the cancellation. As to the imposed fine, we are very much willing to pay the fine. So we will only ask for leniency from the DENR, not to cancel the ECC. If the DENR will grant our motion for reconsideration and reinstate our ECC, we will continue with the reclamation. For every progress, okay, for every development, there must be a sacrifice, okay? But this is a lesser evil, as I am saying, than to destroy the mountains of Coron, than to destroy the forest of Coron.
Russian forces step up their offensive against the last pocket of resistance around Ukraine's Lugansk region as the war enters its fourth month. With Ukraine holding off its neighbors' advances in many areas, including the capital Kyiv, Russia is now focused on securing and expanding its gains in the Donbas and the southern coast. The governor of Lugansk says Russia has sent thousands of troops to capture the entire region. He warns residents in the city of Severodonetsk that it was already too late to evacuate. The Russian parliament passes a bill allowing the shutdown of foreign media bureaus if a Western country has been unfriendly to Russian media. That's in the wake of the closure of some Russian state news outlets in the West. The measure also prohibits the distribution of articles or other materials from outlets that have been closed by the prosecutor's office. It needs to undergo two more readings and be reviewed by the upper house of parliament before it can be signed into law by President Vladimir Putin. Under the current law, media outlets can only be forcibly shut down by a court. Last March, Russia adopted a law penalizing the spread of what it considers fake news against the country's military. Fourteen European tourists who visited Palawan on board a yacht and two Filipino crew members tested positive for COVID-19. They are part of a group who went on a scuba diving trip to Tubataha Reef on May 14. Puerto Princesa's incident management team says all of them are currently in isolation. Last month, 15 other tourists who also went to Tubataha tested positive for the virus. An update now on the growing monkeypox infections. The World Health Organization has recorded more than 250 confirmed and suspected monkeypox cases in at least 16 countries and regions, but the WHO says the outbreak can still be contained.
And it is the objective of the World Health Organization and member states to contain this outbreak and to stop it. The risk for the general public, therefore, appears to be low because we know that the main modes of transmission have been as described in the past.
In business, Philippine economic managers trimmed their 2022 growth forecast for the country due to the impact of Russia's war in Ukraine and rising interest rates. The Development Budget Coordination Committee, or DBCC, now expects the Philippine economy to grow 7-8% this year, narrower than its previous target range of 7-9%. But they retained their growth forecast for 2023 to 2025 at 6-7%. Aside from the war in Ukraine, which has sent oil prices higher, the DBCC also cited the Federal Reserve's aggressive monetary policy tightening and the slowdown of China's economy due to renewed COVID lockdowns as external risks to growth. But the committee said those external risks can be offset by shifting the entire Philippines to COVID alert level 1, increasing the vaccination rate and returning to face-to-face classes. The MRT3 free ride program has been extended until the end of June. The Transport Department said this will help ease the financial burden of commuters who are affected by rising fuel and commodity prices. It adds it will also allow the MRT3 to further test the train's capacity. The free ride offering was first launched back in March. In sports, the Dallas Mavericks finally got a huge monkey off their back. The Mavs earned their first victory in their Western Conference final showdown against the Golden State Warriors. Dallas won Game 4, 119-109, unlike in their losses in the first or in the series' first three games. The Mavericks got their superstar Luka Doncic a lot of help. Doncic still finished with 30 points, while five teammates scored in double figures. The best of seven affair shifts back to the Warriors' home floor with a chance to close out the Mavericks in Game 5. And still on the NBA, reigning two-time MVP Nikola Jokic and fellow international stars Giannis Antetokounmpo and Luka Doncic have been named to the league's first team. Antetokounmpo was a unanimous selection, joining the three in the first team are Boston's Jason Tatum and Devin Booker of the Phoenix Suns. The second team is composed of MVP runner-up Joel Embiid, guard Steph Curry and Ja Morant, and forwards Kevin Durant and DeMar DeRozan. In entertainment, international pop superstar Justin Bieber will hold a concert here in the Philippines. The singer has announced new dates for his Justice World Tour, which now includes Manila. The concert is set to take place October 29th at the CCP Open Grounds. For more on this story, head on over to news.abs-cbn.com. And that'll do it for today. Thanks for joining us. I'm Carmina Constantino. If you want to revisit today's episode, you can play back this newscast on ANC's YouTube channel and on ANC 24/7 on Facebook. Keep safe. Keep it here on the news channel.